Welcome to Give Theory a Chance. In this episode, we are joined by Stefano Block, Associate Professor in the School of Geography and Development at the University of Arizona and author of Going All City, Struggle and Survival in LA's Graffiti Subculture. Stefano discusses and shares some lessons from his recently published article, Crime as Relational Concept in Political Geography. Thanks for joining us today, Stefano.
Thank you.
So you recently published a review article in Geography Compass titled Crime as a Relational Concept in Political Geography. I'm wondering if you could get us going by giving us the origin story for the article.
You know, that article is a perfect example of a piece of scholarly writing that comes out of just sheer frustration. And my frustration was with the degree to which people either refuse or can't see the facts in front of them sometimes because of a partisan lens. And what I mean by that is there are debates and different perspectives on criminalization, criminality, crime as a concept, how much is happening, how little is happening. I get that. I respect that. But there are certain aspects of crime that are tangible, measurable, countable entities. And the prime example of that is murder. And the reason for that is, and I defer to the criminologist Patrick Sharkey at Princeton in the sociology department, who says the reason we use murder as the prime unit of analysis in looking at crime rates and data is because it's hard to hide bodies. And what that means is you can't fabricate the number of murders very easily, but you also can't hide the number of murders very easily. The number of murders is the number of murders, and it's based on the counting of, not to be so dark about this, but it's about the counting of dead bodies. While there may be some noise in the data because of a little bit of an overcount or a little bit of an undercount for a few very interesting reasons, the number of homicides is the number of counted bodies. Well, when you have an objective number like that, that's represented by the horror and trauma of a dead loved one or friend or even stranger, how is it that we're not talking about the same piece of data? How is it that there are impressions and interpretation? So my frustration came out of the fact that there are arguments about what I consider to be, regardless of your partisan perspective, a reality that we could all be talking about, maybe in different ways, but at least we're all talking about the same unit of analysis or data point.
So just to clarify, when you're saying something like we and hearing people talk about it, you're not just talking about academics here. You're talking about the larger public or politics. Like who's making you angry? I feel like it's start therapy session. Who's making you angry about this?
I think I'm one of those people that, no, I'm going to admit it. I am one of those people that finds a way to work what I'm interested in into just about every conversation because I care deeply and I think it's really interesting. So who I'm talking about when I talk about what frustrates me, it's people at the coffee shop. It's my friends around the campfire. And I mean literally the actual campfire. It's people I go to parties with. It's students in classrooms. I have about 1,000 undergraduate students a year in my classes. I talk to them. I talk to colleagues. I talk to strangers sometimes. And I usually bring it back to the issue of crime, but not just crime as some, you know, aspect of the social construct or morality or legalities, but crime as this thing we talk about from different perspectives. So I try to raise it as, no, there are aspects of crime that are objective realities on the ground, yet we persist in having different perspectives of it to the degree that we lose sight of the fact that we're talking about an objective unit of analysis. So to put it simply, I like to bring up the fact that we don't know what we're talking about when we talk about crime because we refuse to be on the same page, even though the page is sitting right in front of our eyes.
So what would be an example of some of the either common assumptions that people are making or some of those perspectives that you see clashing?
Well, based on your political persuasion, you will be sure that crime is always going up and it's getting worse and worse, and we need to find a political figure in our party to fix the problem. That bothers me. It bothers me because if crime was going up year over year for the past 30 years, I would say crime is going up year over year for the past 30 years. If crime is not going up year over year for the past 30 years, well, then I'm going to point that out. And what I have found is that almost everyone thinks that crime is just about always going up. And that just doesn't jibe with the reality that I know from reading people like Patrick Sharkey or reading more theoretical takes on the notion of crime by people like Jack Katz at UCLA. It just doesn't sit well with me. So I looked at the data, and I looked at the data from different sources. But regardless of the sources, I looked at murders because, again, you can count those bodies. And what I found is that crime in as measured by homicide victims, that is the homicide rate and homicide actual numbers, thankfully, rarely goes up year over year over the past 30 years. In fact, it's gone up as many times as I can count on one hand since I was in high school. That's something to be happy about, to be proud about, to celebrate, and more importantly, to perpetuate into the future. Let's keep that going. But because of particular partisan perspectives, people either don't want to know that, refuse to know that, or will find some way to challenge the veracity of that truthful statement. That is frustrating to me because then we can't have conversations about how to keep going in the right direction if you don't even believe that we even know what the right direction is.
One of the things that's interesting about the term review article, and I think that you've mentioned that you don't love that term, is that outside of academia, review sounds like you're just saying exactly what's out there and saying whether you like it or not. And a review article in your article that you wrote is really taking it's providing your perspective to a body of literature and saying, here's these different camps or groups, and I'm going to make an argument by presenting it to you. And so I want to get to the argument that you make, but I'm curious if we could take a moment to think about what are the different ways that academics have approached this idea or concept of crime?
Yeah, well, I'll say about as far as the review article heading goes, a review article is not an annotated bibliography. I think sometimes, especially younger scholars and students, have this idea that a review means you're retelling me what they said. That's an annotated bibliography. That's not a review article. A review article is getting a sense of what the discipline is saying, what good work they've done to help address those concerns or answer those questions, synthesize it, and then find new and hopefully innovative ways to re-articulate those issues for a more contemporary audience and in a way that opens the door for yet more people to do their own review articles. That's not an annotated bibliography. That's a continuation of conversations that, in the case of my own article, have been taking place in my own discipline since before I was born.
What are some of the areas of approaches in the field that you lay out? And obviously we can't get into all of it, but I'm curious if you could provide us kind of a crude mapping so we can see what you're arguing.
Crime hasn't been discussed enough, I think, in the discipline of geography, despite the fact that it's one of the foundation materials for all of society in terms of perspective, in terms of victimhood, perpetuation, the fear it creates, the political import that it raises in society. I mean, crime is right up there with the economy, politics, education, identity. I mean, crime is right there in the mix of the concrete. And geographers don't take it up enough, I feel. And when they do, historically, they take it up as a matter to be mapped. That is, a matter to be located and visualized in the interest of people who will do something about it. So it's very practical in that way. Geographers have been really practical. We will find the problem, we will show you what it is, and then you practitioners and professionals can do something about it. In that way, geographers act almost more like oncologists than they do as scholars. But in the 1970s, as radical geography, you know, critical radical geography really grew up out of Marxist and eventually feminist views on these structures, there was a critique of this. It was like, wait a minute, we're not so simplistic that we're just trying to identify the problem that has already been identified as a problem so that people in the private or public sector can do something about it. Rather, we should be understanding what are the terms, what are the contours of this thing. And that comes out of critical theories from literary studies and cultural studies and economics and all of these fields that do a really good job at unpacking and understanding and, as they say, wrapping your head around a concept that seems so durable, but in fact, it's just a social construct. And the people who did this in geography were simply trying to say, before we fix the problem by locating it, let's stand back and sit and ask ourselves, in whose interest does this problem need to be fixed? So it was very much kind of a Marxian, class-based, power dynamics, hierarchical approach to crime. Then by the time you get to really kind of recently, the 1990s into the 2000s, there's these alternative approaches to crime, you know, alternative mappings of disorder, not crime, or alternative conceptualizations of what people think crime is, but actually should not be considered crimes. Rather, they are forms of expression or being.
Those will be an example of that.
So, for example, one of them comes out of the broken windows theory, which I thought was really interesting. So, oddly enough, I'm talking about people kind of flipping the script on crime, but this comes directly out of Kelling and Wilson's broken windows piece that was published in 1982 in The Atlantic. And what they pointed out was that people thought that the greatest amounts of crime was coming from these particular, you know, front porches of a public housing development in Boston. That's where the most calls for service were coming. That's where people would point to on a map that the most crime was occurring. That was the bad part of town. And what they even say in this article that inspired, you know, decades of pretty conservative policing strategies and tactics, they even say in that own article, no, actually, it's a bunch of guys hanging around not committing crimes, not breaking legal code. They just kind of look like they are. They're giving off the impression that lawlessness is occurring, but objectively, lawlessness is not occurring. And what that did was it really informed this idea that the appearance of crime is sometimes the thing that needs to be fixed because appearances matter. But it's actually not crime we're talking about. It's an illusion or a hinting at or a suggestion of crime that perpetuates your feeling of a lack of safety. That's not the same as crime. So this example I'm giving is, I feel, is kind of an interesting one in that I'm going to the architects of the broken windows theory that inspired decades of broken windows policing that many people would consider to be some of the most conservative form of policing in the past half century.
And so that would be the idea that would lead to policies like criminalizing very small acts of disorder as a more serious thing, because it could lead to, the idea would lead to more occurrences of crime.
Yeah, you know, you go after the small quality of life crimes, not necessarily because those actors will become hardened criminals, but because if you allow small quality of life crimes to occur, it will give the impression that this is a context in which others can more easily commit larger level crimes. So you have to go after the smaller people and the smaller crimes to change perception. I actually think that's the interesting part about broken windows theory. And actually what's interesting about some of the foundations of more conservative policing, it's really theoretical and it's really interested in perceptions. It's really interested in symbolism and what it suggests to the broader population. Even though more conservative notions of policing are often erroneously thought to be more practical and hard, and more progressive styles of policing are thought to be, you know, head in the clouds and philosophical. I don't agree with that. I think some of the most conservative forms of policing are pretty damn philosophical. But for some reason, we refuse to see that these policing strategies and tactics that have real world effects on people, including violating people's constitutional rights through things like stop and frisk in New York City and elsewhere, come out of philosophy.
And so then you present a different way of understanding crime. And this is the part where it's use some of the most complicated terminology. So I want to work through some of that and then think about what it actually means or the implications of it. But you say in your paper that you argue for a flat ontology and suggest that crime itself should not be viewed as just an event, but instead as an ontological category. And that's the part, if I were a student, if I were a person outside academia, or even when I was reading this piece, that was the part where I was like, all right, I have to figure out what is he trying to tell us here? So could you help a little bit explaining those ideas? And then we'll think about how we put those ideas into practice.
Yeah. You know, a lot of really complex and seemingly impenetrable theory and philosophy is sometimes just a matter of re-articulating what we already see playing out on the streets and in our homes and in our lives in a way that conveys a slightly different take to a new audience. That's really what philosophy and theory is. It's a re-articulation of reality in a sophisticated way, because sophisticated articulations lend themselves to building ideas. It just that's the language of this craft, of this field, of the disciplines we're in, of scholarly work, whether or not they take place on a college campus. That actually doesn't matter. And what I did was I looked at my own frustration with the degree to which we can't agree on whether or not crime is going up or down at any given time, even looking back, even retroactively. So I was frustrated. And one of the things I wanted to do was explain that frustration to people, but by ensuring that I wasn't taking sides. I'm not in anyone's pocket. I'm not trying to be partisan. What I'm trying to do is say that your partisan lens, whether or not I otherwise agree with it, actually doesn't matter. But your partisan lens is obscuring your understanding of the thingness of this thing. And the thingness of this thing, in this case, is just the very notion of crime. So I'm moving back many feet. I'm beyond the counted dead bodies. I'm beyond the numerical data. I'm getting to what is the very thingness of the thing we're looking at? What are we even talking about when we talk about crime? And I needed this language that comes out of, you know, decades of great scholarly work by people who existed before I existed. I borrowed some of that language to be able to articulate the fact that crime is not a God-given thing. It is not a thing on the earth that you walk through the forest and you find trees and worms and streams and crime. Crime is actually just a word that we give to describe actions that we as a society have determined are illicit and therefore crime. Crime is a word that identifies things that we think that we should do something about from the perspective of the law. But there's no ontological or existential notion of crime. And if we could agree that crime is actually just a word we give to illicit acts, then we can, instead of talking about whether or not crime is good or bad or up or down, instead we could say, let's think more about how something becomes a crime. Something becomes a crime because we agree that we should do something about it. It's a crime, and therefore there's a code that goes along with it that suggests what punishment should come for committing that crime. Well, then that forces a conversation about conversations, about consensus, legal frameworks, morality, cultural mores. So now all of a sudden you're talking about, why do we think the things we think? Crime isn't just this thing like, ooh, that must be bad because it's crime. It's like, well, we named it crime because we decided that the thing that it identifies is bad. So now we're getting into the realm of constructing society, of constructing our very notion of what is good and bad, which is based on morals and do unto others as you would have them do unto you, etc. So the relational ontology of crime then is the suggestion that instead of continuously arguing about what direction crime is going in, let's take a step back and have a discussion about what are the contributing factors that create the notion itself? What aspects of Republican ideology or Democrat ideology or of the economy or of your community or of your personal desires or of a notion of right or wrong that may or may not be religious or spiritual? What components of all of those social structures contribute to identifying the thing as a crime? Because the crime is the epiphenomenon of the existence of all of these structures and our acceptance of them. And if you get into that conversation, your conversation becomes more temporally elongated. It becomes more geographically elongated. It also becomes more ideologically diverse. And you start to realize that a lot of actors and perspectives over time and space go into creating certain criminological concepts. And I think that's a good way at both defamiliarizing the very notion of crime, but it also forces us to be humble in the face that it isn't bad because it is ontologically bad. We have determined that it is bad because it is not good in this particular context. And by doing that work of relational ontology, what we're doing is we're saying that this thing is not fixed. This thing is not independent. This thing called crime does not predate us. It doesn't exist everywhere equally. Rather, it is co-constructed through our mutual beliefs and desires and understanding of the kind of society we want to live in. So some crimes are more objectively bad. You know, I don't think there's many societies across time or space that think bopping someone over the head with a hammer should not be a crime. But there's a whole bunch of other crimes that are become crimes because we've decided they're not good for the version of society that we have sought to create. And in that sense, it's relational.
So then as a researcher, it pushes you to not just try to get better at counting the numbers, but instead looking at the whole network that shapes which numbers we think are worth counting, or how people why people have the beliefs they do, or why people respond to the numbers, or even it helps us understand the power of a number or belief that isn't necessarily reality, but that doesn't matter. Is that the key part of the flat ontology? Because my belief that there's crime happening in another part of the city impacts the way I act towards that part of the city. It impacts if developers go in and decide that's an area they want to invest. It impacts what type of politician I vote for. Is that part of the story that you're telling?
Yeah, I think, yes. And what it does, I'll put it a different way, is that a relational ontology, or an understanding of how to apply a relational ontological framework to our understanding of this thing we otherwise think is so durable and essential, if we apply that reading to it, what we could say is, oh, there's a lot of impressions involved in this stuff. My feelings determine how I think about this stuff. My political and partisan persuasion determines how I think about this stuff. Oh, even my age, even my income, where I live, all of those things are guiding my perception of a thing that I thought intellectually was a rock. It's not a rock. It's a social construction of all of those aspects of our identity. And I feel that if people realize that, they would become humble in the face of something like crime. That is not to suggest that they should therefore see crime as so relational that it's relativistic and we should just all accept it. Like, oh, crime is no different than baseball or rainbows. No, that's not the point at all. It's my impression of crime is not based in the numbers. It's not based in the reality. I don't change my perception about my feeling of safety in relationship to changing criminological trends. Rather, my view of crime comes from a bunch of stuff that is not tangible, that I can't see, that I didn't even know I had. So now I'm humble in the face of crime because I know that my feelings about it and my expectations for it are coming from a whole host of other ideological structures. And those ideological structures, for a variety of reasons, want me to feel the way they want me to feel. And now I'm kind of hinting at theory by Jack Katz, who has written an amazing piece about crime as myth. You know, a myth isn't just something that's purposefully made up or intended to distract or intended to fool people, but rather it's a myth is something that we can't really decide whether it's wholly true or wholly false, but we know that our subscription and perpetuation of the myth has real world consequences. So if crime is a myth in this sense, and we can get people to believe that it is always occurring and durable and tangible and bad, then that lends power to the people in the political realm who we will vote to do something about it. So the perpetuation of the myth of crime lends power to the people who have fooled you into believing they could do something about it. So there's really kind of a backstage nefarious process in getting us to not realize crime is a relational ontological concept, but rather crime is out there. It's real. It's always been real. It always and will always be bad for you. I'm the only person who could stop it.
One of the challenges of writing any article, but especially review article, the article is, I think, 6 pages long. It's relatively short, right? It's, you have to lay this out in a pretty concise manner. Looking back at what you published, are there any things that you wish you spent more time on or perhaps less time on? Were there things that didn't make it just because of the constraints of writing a review article and having a word count?
You know, I actually, no. It's kind of the opposite of what you're suggesting. You know, is there a frustration that in anything I've done that I would do differently if I had the chance? It's a little bit different than that. Instead, it's because the editors at Geography Compass really encourage this accessible, brief, but hopefully profound statement on a concept. Because they encourage that, you really have to get down to business in terms of identifying the problem and then coming up with the language to discuss it and then hopefully inspire other work that will continue to address it. That's the goal. And what I found in writing this briefer intervention and review article is that I think I've been doing this all along. I look back at you know, dozens of other articles all the way back to my dissertation. And I was like, oh, I've always been doing a relational ontology of stuff. I've always sought to not prioritize certain structural forces as the creators of things. I've always sought to see all of the components that go into the production and perpetuation of an entity as equal, whether I like them or not. I've always tried to understand all of the complex contextualization of a thing or a phenomenon or an entity, but I didn't name it as such. So I was always, going back to my dissertation, trying to understand all of the contributions to the muralization of a wall in Los Angeles, the layers of graffiti and the people who poured the concrete to make it, the political structures that determined whether or not those murals should be illegal or not, the appreciation of the murals, et cetera, et cetera. All the way through to all my articles on prisonization or, you know, carceral geographies, street crime, graffiti, gang identity and territoriality. I've always really sought to not create a hierarchy of more and less important contributors to those phenomenon. And I've always really, without even knowing it, I guess, tried not to find a big structuralist concept that will explain it all for me. That feels dangerous to me. That feels like what we do with crime. It is this thing. Here's the concept that explains it. Now let's do away with it. But in academia, we tend to find more theoretical concepts that explain it all for us. Well, then the debate's over. The discussion's over. And now I just have to accept that concept as the thing that gave birth to this thing or the thing that will cure this thing. And I have nothing else to talk about. But nothing works that way. Everything's always changing and evolving. So I feel like I've always done a relational ontology of processes and identities without going the structuralist route or the conservative, you know, down to basics route, but instead say there's a lot of perspectives, a lot of players, and a lot of participation involved in the creation of what this thing is. And people's, what I consider to be failure to identify it accurately, is not because they're dumb, it's not because they're informed, it's not because they're mean, it's because they are getting the tail end of a story. They're just hearing that the thing is good or bad, and they're not taking into account all of the contributing forces that went into its production. That's what a relational ontology begs, that broader, longer, more in-depth, contextualized, and complex understanding of any kind of phenomena, location, movement, thought, or structure or entity. It really allows for what I consider to be true scholarship to take place.
This is a hard question. I don't know if it's even a fair question, but Right. Do you think that the topics that you were interested led to this theoretical approach? Because if you think about the topics you were exploring, your starting point was really one of the, if you're going to look at something that has a bunch of contested meaning and shifted meanings, people putting paint on a wall is a great example, because there's going to be arguments over whether it's a crime or not. There's going to be arguments about why people are doing it. Depending on what the paint looks like, people are going to have different reactions. Depending if the neighborhood suddenly has a bunch of artists moving in, they're going to have a different response, right? So did that lead you to this type of understanding of crime? Or was it that you think you've always been really excited about those kind of in-between spaces where there's these large networks of different actors with different influences? And do you have a sense of, did the theory guide your empirical interest, or in trying to understand your empirical interest, did you have to find a theory that helped us understand how something like graffiti could be or could not be criminalized?
Well, the way you just asked that question just made me realize something that I'm not 100% sure I realized before. And that is, I think I remember kind of the moment that a scholar, a geography, kind of inspired me to be like, oh, wait a minute, this is a relational ontological question. It's not a question of in or out. And to, you know, really paraphrase the title of his book, In Place or Out of Place. This book by Tim Cresswell, who's a geographer who writes about graffiti. I'll get to that in a second, but what I want to say is, no, it was doing illicit acts. It was living in the margins. It was being someone who's been criminalized and dispossessed and displaced and made homeless, but also given so many opportunities to operate in the realm of institutions and legitimate spaces, that has always given me a sense of the fact that there are competing and different and contradictory and collaborative spaces all through society. I'm never just in or out. We're always moving our way through a variety of ins and outs. And so that background as a graffiti writer, as, you know, a formerly homeless youth with my mother, as an impoverished person who has degrees at some of the best institutions in the country, who now, you know, has the ability to pay my mortgage. I feel like I've operated in a lot of different spaces. But as a scholar, the moment that I think I started to think relationally was when Tim Cresswell says, there's no, and I'm paraphrasing, of course, but there's no question whether or not graffiti is legal or illegal. It's illegal. That's what graffiti is. It's the illegal marking of infrastructure. It doesn't matter how beautiful it is. Doesn't matter how ugly it is. It doesn't matter how much you appreciate it or hate it. If you do it, it is codified as an illicit act. It's vandalism. But why is it a crime? Why does it become part of this seemingly durable concept of crime? Is it the materiality of the thing? Well, graffiti is literally the application of pigment on a surface. So have we as a society determined that the less than millimeter thick application of pigment is destructive for a civil free society, you know, structurally speaking? Well, no one thinks that. No one thinks it's about the pigment. Well, if it's not about the pigment, well, why is it a crime? Is it that all graffiti writers, once they're done spraying their name, bop people over the head with hammers? Well, no, we don't really think that. I mean, that's ridiculous. That's comical. Well, then why is graffiti a crime? Because it is. Graffiti is a crime, he says, because it transgresses and contests the idea that we are in control over the aesthetic environment of our society. And a society that obeys rules and decides that abiding by the law is good for us, graffiti suggests that there is an alternative. And when you allow the alternative to exist, you create alternative ideologies that might start to question society as it is. Why are walls white? What is that symbolizing or suggesting? Why can't we mark the walls? Why is my agency not important enough that I could express my individuality through the application of pigments? Graffiti is illegal because it suggests that another world is possible. It suggests that there are alternative ways to exist in our society that are equally not destructive, that are equally not claiming people's lives, that are equally actually pretty innocuous. But that alternative aesthetic reality might just make us become more likely to break other rules. And that can contribute to another world. Not a world in which a small percentage of people make the most profits. Not another world in which these religious leaders, political leaders, and thought leaders get to stay in power. But a world in which maybe you'll have an inversion of morals or an inversion of the hierarchy. Or, as Jeff Farrell, the critical criminologist, would say, a world that is anarchic, not chaotic, but the actual word of anarchic. Graffiti suggests that you could have a world that smooths out hierarchical relationships, and you have an anarchic world in which we're all actually equal, and we decide day to day what should rightfully constitute a crime without relying on people 249 years ago to tell us what a crime will be for the rest of our existence. Graffiti just alerts us to an alternative social construction.
I should have known by bringing up that example that was going to get you on a run of ideas. But so to go back, it seems like it was you had this thing that you had done and experienced, and then you found a theory that helped you understand it. And that was your first, you both felt it, but then you were drawn into this understanding of a relational ontology. The theory worked because it helped you understand things you're already feeling. If you had not been feeling, you probably wouldn't have been drawn to it in the same way.
I think a negative and false characterization of theory is that sometimes scholars make up words or terms or theories to explain things that most people don't even think exists. That's not true. I think what theory does is it allows you to re-articulate and problematize something we're all already experiencing, yet we don't quite have a new form of language to help us understand its genealogy, its existence, its ontological existence. So good theory, I think, starts with an observation of the real world. Good theory helps us explain what we're already doing unconsciously or doing collectively or doing in ways that help the world exist as it exists. Theory doesn't predate the problem. Theory is what we look for to help better understand and potentially solve the problem.
One of my motivations for this run of podcast episodes is I think that as academics, we don't take enough time in our article writing, or even more sadly in the classroom, is helping people understand, here's a lesson you can take from the research. So here's this argument I worked through. I'm going to present you with all these different reasons for why I've come up with this conclusion, or ways of understanding whatever the data is I'm exploring, or summarizing, like you're doing, these different approaches to understanding something and putting forth a way that I think is better. But what is the thing that you could walk away with and say, okay, this is going to shape the way I live my life, or a way I'm going to perceive the world? So if you had to boil down all the stuff you just said and said, all right, audience, here's one thing that you can take from this, one reminder that you can give yourself, maybe even something that you do different when you wake up in the morning, what would that one thing be?
What I would want students and scholars who read this article to come away with is the understanding that not all seemingly durable concepts have always been here and are unchanging, and therefore we need to find ways to defeat them or perpetuate them. Rather, the thing we're talking about itself is a product of so many collaborations and different contexts that go into its fundamental being and understanding. So if we bring a relational ontological framing to things, what we're saying is, let's stand back, let's be humble, let's look at all of the contributing factors that go into the production of this thing, and let's have a more nuanced, fair conversation about whether or not we want this thing to exist at all, or the degree to which it is bad or good or immoral or moral, or should be illicit or licit. And I think that by lending a relational ontology to a variety of artifacts, phenomena, language, existences, we're asking for humility in the face of complexity. I think that humility in the face of complexity is a better starting point for theorizing stuff in society than coming into it with the notion that it is essentially, fundamentally good or bad.
Okay, that's a great place to end. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Appreciation goes to Jeffrey Gilbert for providing theme music, SUNY Brockport for providing financial support, and most importantly, on behalf of me, Kyle Green, thank you for giving theory a chance.